listening to a Lilith podcast. You can subscribe to Lilith Magazine, independent, Jewish, and frankly feminist, at www.lilith.org, where you can also find the Daily Lilith blog, other great podcasts, information on ordering back issues, and much, much more. Just click on www.lilith.org. Hi, Lilith podcast listeners. You're about to be privy to something very special, excerpts of lectures given by three scholars of American Jewish history and an exclusive event held by Lilith Magazine and the American Jewish Historical Society on the 12th of April, 2010. We hope you enjoy these special selections. For more information, go to www.lilith.org.
The wonderful scholars we're going to present to you today are going to be introduced to you by Susan Malbon. Susan is a historian and the director of the library and archives here, and she is the person who has produced Exhibit A, the white gloves without which we are forbidden to go near any of this. I don't know if you tried to bring any water or coffee, chas v'chalila, into this room, but this is the rules are very strict here. She runs a very tight ship. So Susan Malbon, and thank you all for coming.
Hi, good morning. First, just I want to tell you a word about our collections. While we were founded in 1892, we have collections that go back to the 1700s. But most of the collecting and acquiring in its early stages was done by men. And there are lacunae in our holdings about women and women's activities. There's very little from the 18th century. There's a lot more from the 19th century. But formal women's institutional holdings only begin in the 20th century. And we're looking to you to create informational work.
Susan, can you lift the mic a little bit?
Hello? Did you all forget? Well, that's great. You know, I have a loud voice. Anyway, I'll just start with our first scholar. Dr. Annie Polland is Vice President of Education at the Tenement Museum and the author of Landmark of the Spirit, an exceptional photo essay and literary tour of the Eldridge Street Synagogue. And she's currently working on the relationship of culture and religion, and she'll talk about 19th century materials. And the 19th century materials she'll talk about are spread out on the table in front of you. And then we'll have a second scholar, Dr. Hasia Diner, who will arrive. And she's the Paul and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History and Judaic Studies and Director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History at NYU. And in addition to her recent prize-winning book, We Remember with Love and Reverence, Hasia's books include The Jews of the United States, 1645 to 2000. Her works praise her, A History of Jewish Women in America from Colonial Times to the Present, and several other materials. She'll talk about 18th century materials. And then after lunch, our final scholar, Deborah Dash Moore, will speak. She's the professor, full professor, Frederick C. L. Hootwell, professor of history at the University of Michigan and director of the Jean and Samuel Frankel Center for Judaic Studies. She's the author of At Home in America, Second Generation New York Jews, and To Golden Cities, Pursuing the American Jewish Dream in Miami and L.A. And more recently, she's co-edited the award-winning two-volume Jewish Women in America, an historical encyclopedia. And now, Annie.
Good morning. I just want to thank the American Jewish Historical Society for inviting me to be part of this and to really praise the work that they've done in creating a format like this. I think a lot of historians are used to presenting finished products, or they're talking about books they've already written, or they've already made sense of all this material that's out here. And what the American Jewish Historical Society has done is kind of reverse that by putting all these objects on a table and making us kind of go backwards and talk about how we know what we know. So it's a wonderful project. It actually takes much more work than simply inviting people to come and speak. It's something I do at the institutions that I've worked at. When I've invited scholars to come, I make them talk about the site that they're in rather than having them recycle the talk that they've given countless places before. And now, in a way, I feel like I'm getting a taste of my own medicine because it's much harder to kind of take a bunch of the stuff and piece it together. So hopefully you'll bear with me as I do that. I'm going to talk about the 19th century in an hour and start by talking about objects that are on the table that I actually just learned about last week. So this is new to me as well. The two candlesticks. Oh, sure. Or actually, I have a pretty loud voice. If I talk like it, can you all hear me at this level? Can you hear me in the back? Okay. So these are candlesticks from the 19th century, and I believe they were originally made in Warsaw. They were purchased in St. Petersburg by a family that lived in Kiev. And it was Jacob Grossman and his wife Edith, and they lived in Kiev. He ran a factory, a garment shop, or a garment manufacturer, and in the late 1880s, there was some violence, anti-Jewish violence, and according to the story, one of the factory members ran to the Grossman home to warn them, you know, that this is anti-Jewish mob coming after them. They came after him anyway, shot the employee, came inside, shot Edith Grossman's mother, who ended up dying the next day, and shot the candlesticks. And you can see the bullet hole in them. This is not, my guess is that many of you have seen candlesticks that have traveled across the ocean. How many of you have candlesticks in your home? That came right. So, I mean, this is a wonderful way, in many ways, to begin our talk about the 19th century, specifically women's role in it, because when we see candlesticks, I mean, I would even guess that when you see the candlesticks at home, you think of certain people. Yeah, okay, good. When I see my candlesticks, I think of my grandmother. And my candlesticks were brought over by her mother in 1906. So we have these associations with candlesticks. And this story is amazing, in a way, of these candlesticks that came over. The Grossmans ended up settling in Boston in 1892, a few years after. They stayed in Kiev, and then a few years after, finally made it to America. They brought with them a samovar, they brought with them some crystal, some other, you know, their best possessions, and these Sabbath candlesticks, and according to the notes that I have here from the American Jewish Historical Society, they lit the candlesticks every week until Edith passed away, I think in 1957 at the age of 83. Now, you can even see this as a movie, right? The beginning of a movie, maybe even filmed by Quentin Tarantino, right? The Kiev, the person running after, the shot that hits the candlestick. You know, in his movie, they'd leave the next day and make it over to America. But obviously, history is not a Quentin Tarantino movie, and he doesn't intend his movies to be history either. But this is an extraordinary story, but what I find more extraordinary and more fascinating is actually the more ordinary stories of the candlesticks that I imagine, again, are in your homes without bullet holes. I forgot to ask how many of your candlesticks have the bullet holes. Okay, so we're on the same page with that. Mine don't either. But, I mean, again, this is a remarkable story. Again, in the narrative that you could see is, you know, leaving pogroms and going to the enlightened nation of America where freedom rules and everyone's happy afterwards. But in many cases, you can almost see the complications of America written in the candlesticks in a different way than the complications of Europe. So if the complications of Europe are engraved or written into the candlesticks through the bullet holes, I would say the complications of America could be read in a gleaming pair of candlesticks, right? Polished, beautiful. Why is that a complication? Unused, right? I mean, and I think that's the other part of the story. I mean, these candlesticks, I don't know what happened to the Grossman family. This isn't a family that I've studied, but these were donated, and I don't know if their grandchildren are lighting candlesticks or not. So one of the biggest questions and one of the biggest challenges as well as the opportunity is the role of religious life in America. What happens to religious life in America? If you have freedom of religion, you also have freedom from religion. And how are people going to negotiate those freedoms and opportunities? So in the next hour, 50 minutes or so, we'll look at candlesticks and we'll look at religious life and look at what particular women did to negotiate those challenges. The framework and the backdrop for all of this is kind of understanding the 19th century as the beginning of the century of migration. And Hasia Diner, who will be here next, has done a wonderful job of really making historians, making people think of the 19th century in a different way and of American Jewish history in a different way. For a long time, American Jewish historians kind of divided up American Jewish history in three sections, a kind of the tripartite division, where you have the Sephardic wave from 1654 to 1820, starting with the boat, the 23 boatload, the boat of 23 immigrants who came to New Amsterdam. Then you have the German migration from 1820 to 1880, and then 1880 to 1920 is the East European Jewish migration. But what she did is she said, let's just think of this as a century of migration, and let's stop thinking of what divides the 1820 to 1880 group from the 1880 to 1920 group, and think more of the similarities. So in this time frame of a century, approximately 3 million Jews left Europe, about a quarter of Europe's Jews altogether, came to America. And if you think about Eastern Europe, it's even more. It's about a third of Eastern Europe's Jews left, and 90% of them came to America. Whether they came in the 1830s on a more traditional sailing vessel, or they came in 1900 in a steamship, so whether their journey took months or their journey took 2 weeks, many of them are going to become emancipated just with that boat ride, and they're going to come to America and have a new life. In the 19th century, industrialization hits Europe. That dislocates a lot of traditional occupations. There's reasons why people want to leave for economic opportunity that America has. And then also in the 1820s, you have the opening of the Erie Canal, which situates New York and creates even more opportunity. So there's less opportunity in Europe, economic opportunity, more economic opportunity in America, not to mention the additional political freedom. So you have this amazing migration over to America. And even once you get here, and even once you're settled, your experience in many ways is going to be framed by this ongoing migration. So if you take someone who arrives in New York in the 1830s or 1840s, and again, this is to what's so great about Hasia Diner's paradigm and this idea of the century of migration is it makes us question some of the collective memory that's come down. I think when you would say, what is a German Jew, for a long time people would think, oh, the owner of Macy's or a department store owner. But when you go to 1840, those one day, perhaps, department store owners are running a secondhand shop on Chatham Square. Right, Chatham Square, which is now the heart of Chinatown, that was the Jewish settlement, the Five Points area that we, through Martin Scorsese, I'm just going to do all sorts of film references today, we think about through Gangs of New York. This is the area where many Jews are settling, and they're starting their lives as secondhand clothing merchants. They're going to they're glaziers, they're putting in glass, and these very tough jobs, working all day, often working on Saturday, right? Because in order to get by, you're going to need to work on Saturday for many of these people. But by 1880, let's say their kids are now settled on the East 50s or the East 60s. They've moved uptown. They're a member of Central Synagogue, then called Ahavat Chesed. Their life is still framed by migration, because they might run garment shops downtown and their workers are East European Jews. Or they might run a cigar shop downtown or cigar factory and their workers are East European Jews. So they're interacting and their whole life is shaped in many ways by immigration. And in terms of a Jewish community, new immigrants arriving demand a communal response. So even in 1873, let's say 1873, the Great Panic, the largest depression that's hit New York or the United States up to that point in history. It's been overshadowed a bit by some more recent developments. But at that point, that throws New Yorkers out of work, and about a quarter of New Yorkers lose work. And Jews are among these unemployed. Jewish communal institutions respond by creating the United Hebrew Charities in 1874, which is the first kind of major united effort to deal with this issue. And so it's Jews who have been here a little bit longer now taking care of the newly arrived. And you see this pattern over and over and over again, not just in New York Jewish history, but United States Jewish history, the way in which Jews already here feel the need to take care of their own. Women play roles to some extent in these organizations, but one of the greatest things that historians have found about the 19th century is the way in which women carved out their role to some extent in synagogues. We know that by the late 19th century, many of the people attending synagogues were women. We also know that by the late 19th century, due to the advances of the reform movement, women have moved, in some cases, from the balcony onto the sanctuary floor. They become part of the choirs. But a lot of this has happened not so much because of an idea of women's right, more so to kind of mimic or parallel what's going on in Protestant congregations and to show middle-class affiliation. But women's major roles happened outside the synagogue. It's when they took an opportunity to do something, in many ways, for new immigrants coming, that I think they really created and carved out new roles. And in doing this, what they often did is they looked to what Protestant women were doing. And they took the formats that Protestant women created and infused it with Jewish content. And that was incredibly innovative. I think probably one of the most famous women of the 19th century, and my guess is you've heard of her, is Rebecca Bratz. She's Philadelphia, so she's not New York, so we won't spend that much time on her. But in 1838, she created the Jewish Sunday School. Again, a major role, and in part this was influenced by her work working with Philadelphia Protestant women and looked at the way they were caring for their poor. She came from a wealthy family. She had a wonderful education. She worked with her mother and her sisters. They joined other benevolent associations that just dealt with the Philadelphia poor in general. What she found in doing that, though, is that Christian women, even with the best of intentions, really wanted to missionize, right? They wanted to convert these Jews to become Christian in many sense. So she realized the need to have, for Jews to have their own organizations. And in 1819, she created the Female Hebrew Benevolent Association or Society. And in 1838, she created that Sunday School. And when she created that Sunday School, she couldn't go down to the bookstore downstairs and buy Jewish books for the kids to read. What she did is she took textbooks from the Christian Sunday School Association, and just kind of crossed out sections that that deviated from Judaism or called question, and worked with those materials. And again, and then in the process, created her own materials. And she worked with the Rabbi Isaac Leeser, incredibly important to Philadelphia and to American Judaism as well. But it was her initiative that got that school started, and she stayed teaching there for many, many years. And her collection is here. At the American Jewish Historical Society. So it's the boxes in the front. So again, I want to come back to New York. And a woman who actually grew up in this very neighborhood, the Union Square neighborhood, was a woman named Emma Lazarus. And she was the product of a Sephardi and Ashkenazi family, extremely wealthy. The father was a sugar refiner, Moses Lazarus. He had educated his 7 children very well, especially Emma. And she showed at an early age talent as a writer. And he encouraged that. He even published one of her books that I think was a poem she wrote between the ages of 14 and 17. She struck up a relationship with Emerson and sent her poetry to him. Her writing was published in Century Magazine and all sorts of American magazines. And of course, she became most famous for writing the poem The New Colossus. And that I'll also pass around. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I won't touch it, but I will. It's here, and it's actually open to...
Why
can't
you let people
walk
around
here? Okay. After during talk, this is her notebook, and she's open to the new Colossus. And I've got it cropped because I'm just finding it kind of...
So feel free to take a look. I'll read it just so you have it. It's a short poem. That you know, and of course, this was the bottom of that notebook. It says, "In aid of the Bartholdi pedestal." What this was, you know, France gave the Statue of Liberty to America, but America needed to still raise the money to have a pedestal. And so Emma Lazarus was invited to create a poem that would be part of an auction to raise money for the pedestal. And eventually, in 1903, the poem was inscribed on the base of the pedestal as well. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. So that poem is here, right in front of you and in the collection of the American Jewish Historical Society. And it also allows us to think about for a moment how Jews already here were reacting to the arrival in the 1880s in large number of these East European Jews. The phrase, you know, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore, the homeless and the tempest tossed, you get the impression that they're not arriving, right, with brand new clothes and suitcases, right, that these are poor immigrants arriving. And not all Jews of Central European background were thrilled about this because of the responsibility it placed on them. In the late 1870s, a wave of kind of social anti-Semitism began, with Jews being restricted from hotels and clubs. And in part, that played into this reaction to these East European Jews arriving. And not everyone was a poet. So there were all sorts of reactions to this, but by far, when you look at the Jewish community as a whole, they reacted strongly, creating all sorts of networks and institutions and emboldening institutions that already existed to deal with the new immigrants arriving. So Emma Lazarus herself not only wrote poetry, but she worked for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. She went to Ward's Island to visit new immigrants arriving, and she helped found the Hebrew Technical Institute, an organization that would give Jewish boys a vocation and train them to become, to be able to get what better paying jobs than what they had were able to get before. Another woman who arrives about the same time, she's not born in New York, but she is actually born in Central Europe, but immigrates as a young girl with her father, who's a rabbi, and lives in South Carolina and then in San Francisco. Rebecca Bettelheim Kohut, she was born in 1864. She arrives in New York in 1886. And again, she's the daughter of a rabbi. She's soon to meet the man that would be her husband. She's just going to become the wife of a rabbi. She would marry Alexander Kohut. Her first week in New York, her very first week in New York, she visits Castle Garden. And Castle Garden was the immigrant station that existed before Ellis Island. Ellis Island isn't built until 1892, and before that, most immigrants simply got off the boat and walked through Castle Garden. And this time, when she went to Castle Garden, she was there with Emma Lazarus and Henry Pereira Mendes, who was the rabbi of Sheirit Israel. And she talks about how being at Castle Garden with Emma Lazarus and meeting these immigrants and seeing the immigrants get off the boat kind of changed her life. As I said, she would marry Alexander Kohut by February of 1887. Alexander Kohut has 8 children already. He's a widower, and has 8 children. And so she marries him at the age of 23, takes on this amazing responsibility. And he serves Ahavat Chesed congregation, which is now known as Central Synagogue. And she worked with him there. But at the age of 25, she wanted to kind of break out from the routine of simply being a wife and mother. And this had not, and you'd think that having 8 children would be enough, but she there was more for her to do. And she had some kind of these early works with women in her neighborhood. She met a woman in her neighborhood who ran a kind of a health association, and she helped her, and she did a great job, got up and gave a speech, was quoted in a newspaper. But apparently her husband wasn't so excited about that. She wrote, "My husband, while rather proud that what I had said seemed worthy of quotation, was dubious of the wisdom of a public career for me. He felt that I had much to do at home and was more or less jealous of any time I gave to others." So that wasn't going to work. So she's going to try again. And she hears the speech that Rabbi Gustav Gottheil at the nearby Temple Emmanuel gave, that he addressed the women of his congregation, saying, you should form a sisterhood, and your sisterhood should go out and help the new immigrants who are arriving. She thought that was wonderful, and then would go back to her congregation and form the second sisterhood in America. And she writes, realizing that an organization of this kind gave women opportunities for worthy service among the poor, I urged upon my husband that a similar institution be formed among the women of his congregation. It seemed to be the work that I could do for him, and he consented. So she's going to do public work, but this, by framing it, is as something that the congregation is doing. She knew she was going to get her husband's support. And I think it's remarkable that she wrote this in her memoir, her autobiography, let's say, that was over 40 years after this happened. She made sure to say, he said it was okay. He allowed it. You know, because that was also part of the time. You wanted to do something that wasn't, even if it was radical in action, it showed that it was coming from a definition of womanhood or of Jewish womanhood that sat well with the people of the community. So she was then going to take her wifely and motherly virtues and extend them outside of her home, outside of the congregation, and into the very streets of New York. And to give you a sense of how radical this is, I just want to describe to you where she lived. She lived with her husband at Beekman Place. Is anyone familiar with Beekman Place?
Yeah.
Right, it's like a two-block stretch of brownstones. Well, when it was built, it was a two-block stretch of beautiful brownstones between 49th and 50th Street, right along the river. And it's interesting, the husband bought a home for her because when he himself arrived in New York, he read a book by a man named Henry Harland, who had changed his name to Sidney Luska. Henry Harland was a Protestant, but wanted to write, he was captivated by the Jews, the Central European Jews, and wanted to write novels about them. So he wanted to be the kind of the first Jewish novelist, or the first non-Jewish Jewish novelist, to write about them. And he wrote a book in 1887 called The Yoke of the Torah. It happened to be the first book that Alexander Kohut read in English when he arrived from Prague. And he was so taken by this book, the heroine of the book lived on Beekman Place. Alexander Kohut would go on these walks to Beekman Place. He was so struck by this. And then when he met Rebecca and was courting Rebecca, would take her on walks through there. They became engaged. He went on a walk, saw one of the houses was for sale. So he bought that house so that they could live in this house that was in the novel. And Henry Harland then became their neighbor. Which was wonderful because then it led me to the novel and I could read the novel and get an idea of what it was like to live on Beekman Place. It's grand when you get there, says the heroine of the novel. It's fearfully out of the way, but it's grand when you get there. There's a wonderful view from the bay window up, down, and across the river. You can feast in the open air while the sky and river glowed. They sat on stoops on summer evenings with their neighbors who were respectable marble dealers, judges, and lawyers. And Henry Harland, too. And so these beautiful, you could go fishing in the water in the East River, and these wonderful sunsets. So it was a middle-class lifestyle unimaginable to the very same immigrants who she had met at Castle Garden when they were arriving. And those immigrants were moving into the area that we now know of as the Lower East Side. But by creating this sisterhood, Rebecca Kohut and her colleagues would leave Beekman Place, would leave the brownstones of the East 50s and go to the Bowery. And in the Bowery, in East 3rd Street and East 2nd Street, they started to make connections to Jewish families that were living in tenement apartments. They set up a little station for themselves on 3rd Street. And what they would do down there is they would set up kindergartens, they would set up sewing circles to teach the daughters sewing, they set up milk stations, they helped find employment, and they would visit the women in the tenements. She writes about how they would climbed flight after flight of the East Side tenement's creaking stairs and experienced firsthand how spaces were divided and subdivided into tiny cubicles called rooms without air or daylight. So in these tenements, they would then pay what were called friendly visit friendly visits to clinically assess the state of these homes, figure out what these women needed, write reports, and then make sure these women and these families got what they needed from the synagogue and from the United Hebrew Charities, which they became part of very quickly. And this, it wasn't just Ahavat Chesed's congregation that did this. Temple Manuel's was doing this, and sisterhoods sprouted up throughout Manhattan among these congregations, and then got paired up with districts in the Lower East Side or in Harlem or other places where immigrants would start to settle. And then these women were responsible for these territories and started to apply all these ideas of the progressive movement at the time, which was to kind of study everything you could, make reports of everything you could so that you could find a solution. This was a time that the city was growing from 1 million in the 1860s to 5 million by the mid-1910s. The city was growing, the population was growing, not just because of Jewish immigrants, but immigrants from Italy, from Greece, from all over. And the city didn't have the resources to respond. So middle-class women in general started to respond by forming these clubs, forming these associations, and Rebecca Kohut's sisterhood and the other sisterhood kind of again took this model of charitable work but infused it with Jewish content. So you might ask, what was it that they did that was Jewish as opposed to what an organization such as the King's Daughters, a Protestant organization, did? Well, the King's Daughters could go, and the King's Daughters might give shoes and they might give clothes, but they weren't going to give matzahs at Passover, right? And this is something that these women did. And actually, this is an aside, but one of these boxes here has the records from 1859 matzah distribution, where the congregations at the time got together and passed out matzahs to immigrant Jews living in the Lower East Side on Orchard Street and Broom Street. And again, when you think of the Lower East Side, you think of the East European Jewish immigrants, but at this point these were German-born, or, you know, Bavarian-born or Prussian-born Jews living on the Lower East Side who needed money so that they could buy kosher matzah. So again, this idea of charity is extremely important. What was new with the sisterhoods was that it was all organized by women. So Rebecca Kohut's going downtown. She's part of this life. The Federation joins, and the Federation talks about the meaning of their work. And again, that the meaning of their work is Jewish. They're very well aware of organizations like the King's Daughters and other organizations whose goal in part was to missionize in 1890. There's an amazing building on the corner of Christie and Delancey Street. If you go to it now, it's a Seventh-day Adventist church. But you look at the cross, guess what's right under the cross? A Star of David. So you see the layers of history, but what most people don't know is that it started out as a church. Started out as a Protestant church in 1890, which was insane because all the other Protestant congregations had moved uptown. Why is there a Protestant church opening in 1890? To missionize, right? So they set up, but within a few years they gave up and a Jewish congregation bought it. But they're aware, you know, Rebecca Kohut's aware of the missionizing tendencies of many of these Protestant women, some of whom are her friends, experiencing the same thing that Rebecca Graff had experienced, and felt that it was so important for Jews to have their own charitable organizations run by women. They also thought that they were responsible for bridging a class divide. They repeatedly said, you know, these are our sisters and our brothers. There is a class divide between us who live uptown and they who live downtown. We as women can bridge that divide. But one thing they weren't able to do necessarily, you know, you have these two goals, you know, spreading religious life, encouraging religious life, but also bridging the class divide. They sound like goals that could go together, but in the reality of the late 19th and early 20th century, these things can't easily go together. Any sense of why? What's coming in between staying religious and becoming middle class, or becoming even, you know, just getting a job? Sabbath, right? So we're back to the candlesticks here, in a sense. The work week in America, up until the 1930s, 1950s, was a 6-day work week, Monday through Saturday. And many East European Jewish immigrants who arrived, although many had been Orthodox or had observed a traditional lifestyle, found that in order to get a job, they would have to work on the Sabbath. And Rebecca Kohut writes about this extensively in her autobiography. She writes, aside from the actual material suffering, the situation produced many a family tragedy. The younger generation was readier to adapt itself to American conditions, and while the old folk bitterly opposed their working on the Sabbath, and in general assuming the ways of Gentiles, yet they found themselves dependent upon their children for support. It was a sad state of affairs. Kohut was sensitive, but she realized her sensitivity was not enough to change things, and she writes further, and I am willing to confess that I induced many an erudite scholar to join the army of sweatshop laborers in preference to being reduced to destitution. So even when you have a congregation attempting to do religious work, you kind of run against the economic currents of the time, which threw many people into labor on the Saturday, labor on the Saturday or the Sabbath, depending on how you view it. So you, the sisterhoods raising money, buying clothes, creating Hebrew schools, creating religious schools for these children, but not able to deal with that situation. Now, many years later, you start to see among the East European Jewish women a way in which they've looked at women like Rebecca Kohut as a model, because they then formed their own sisterhoods in their East European Jewish congregations that in many ways mirror or parallel what had been done uptown. So this is from the Eldridge Street Synagogue, which, has anyone ever been there before? Gorgeous, restored synagogue, the first East European synagogue built on the Lower East Side of Moore Synagogue. Women sat on the balcony. They did not lead services. They were not. They couldn't even be members. They weren't members until 1907. And I don't think it's a coincidence that widows could become members in 1907 because Isaac Gellis had died, one of the founding members and a very rich man, leaving Sarah Gellis as his widow. I think that's when they amended their constitution to say widows could join. But so you start to have women involved in some way. Sarah Gellis is a leader by virtue kind of her wealth. But in 1919, they formed a ladies' auxiliary. And the ladies' auxiliary, every Saturday night, would bring their best china, their best food, bring it to the synagogue. It opened the synagogue doors to the neighborhood needy. And so this was kind of in some ways paralleling what had been done upstairs. From an oral history, woman who's now in her 90s remembers her mother being part of this ladies' auxiliary. She said Saturday night was when all the hobos, when all the Jewish hobos came to the synagogue. But this was part of the organization that this ladies' auxiliary did. This is from inviting everyone to a special meeting in December to plan their Hanukkah festival. So just like the sisterhoods planned for the East European Jewish women, Purim and Hanukkah festivals, they did the same thing. They chose the same holidays to create festivals in which they used that time to establish ties between their members and to do a lot of important networking and charitable work. So this is in Yiddish, but I'll pass it around, and I should have been wearing my gloves, so I'll... But it takes a while. So this isn't until 1919, the 1920s, where the congregations are creating these formal organizations. In the meantime, East European Jewish women have to figure out ways to respond to the Sabbath dilemma and the strains of migration and what that poses to religious lifestyles. Very different from Rebecca Kohut is a woman named Rachel Gollop, and later on she would publish her work under a memoir called Out of the Shadow, which is a wonderful kind of window onto East European Jewish life in New York. She talks about the decade of the 1890s, and her father came first. They left the family behind. She came at the age of 12 with an aunt and went through the whole journey to America, to the Lower East Side, joined her father, who was living in a tenement on Cherry Street. He was working in the garment industry. I think she had a few weeks off in America to just kind of observe, but within a few weeks, she too was in the sweatshop with her father. She's 12 years old, and she's working these incredibly long hours, and she's miserable. She misses her mother, she misses her brothers, her sisters, and she and her father fight a lot. There's all sorts of tension between them. She takes him to task. Why is your beard shortened? You know, in Europe, you would have never shortened your beard. Keep in mind, he didn't shave his beard entirely. He just shortened his beard. But she said, why is your beard shortened? And he said, I live on Cherry Street, and we live on Cherry Street so that the rents are cheaper here. But there's a lot of Irish, and that's the reason why the rents are cheaper. The landlords want us to live here. The rent is cheaper, but we're taunted by the Irish. If I shave my beard, I might be taunted less. And you kind of understand that action, not as a rejection of Jewish life or tradition, but an attempt to accommodate to America so he can get a cheaper apartment, save more money, and be able to reunite his family sooner rather than later. She also yells at him because on the first Sabbath they're walking along and she's overwhelmed by the abundance, right? The fruits and the vegetables, all this stuff for sale. He says, do you want a fruit? She picks out a melon and she sees her father hand over the coin and she is beside herself because such a thing would never have happened in Europe. So they have these clashes about who are you and what are you doing here. But finally, they kind of come together in happiness because by the end of the year, he saved enough money for tickets for her mother and the children. And all of a sudden, they're kind of flooded with hope. And they even move out of they had been living as boarders in a woman's house. They rent a two-bedroom apartment on Broome Street, kind of moving up. And it's the Friday afternoon that the mother's going to arrive. And the boat has arrived, but they're not going to disembark on the Sabbath. She knows her mother's on the boat. She's cleaning the apartment, the tenement, furiously. And she realizes it's Sabbath. The Sabbath is going to begin, and her mother doesn't have, you know, might not be able to light the candles. So she wants to light the candles. For the first time in America, I felt the Jewish spirit here. I wanted to light the candles. She doesn't have candlesticks. She doesn't have candlesticks that she's brought over because her mother has them. She runs outside, and she grabs a brick, and she takes the brick, and she puts candles in the bricks, right, the holes in the bricks, and lights the candles there. And again, it's because her mother is on the boat and her brothers and sisters are there that she now feels the Sabbath spirit in America. The mother comes. There's all sorts of adaptations. Namely, you know, she has her mother take off her kerchief and arrange her hair differently. But they're continuing to accommodate to America. And the candlesticks, in many ways, become a way that people can do this. By the 1900s, you start to have published prayers for women, supplications that women would say when they lit the candlesticks, right? After they would say the traditional prayer, women would often say an additional prayer that kind of had their hopes and ambitions and dreams. And there had been published books, so if you didn't know your own or you didn't have your own, there were models that you could use. And they started to be published in Yiddish in the 1700s in Central Europe and spreading to Eastern Europe. In 1916, the Hebrew Publishing Company, which was located over on Delancey Street, publishes a book of Tichinus, of the supplications for women, and many of them are supplications that had been written in Europe. But one of them was a supplication that had been written in America. It's called A New Supplication for Candle Lighting in America. Part of it says, you know, we are ordered to lend beauty to these days through good food and with fine clothing, and everyday profane matters are not appropriate on the Sabbath. And I have to say that in America, a lot of that is easier. There's an abundance of goods, even if you're poor. There are many more goods for sale that allow you to kind of clean your home and decorate your home. But this is the other part of the supplication. I ask you, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that you should guard and shelter me, my husband, and my children from Sabbath and holiday desecration. Send us to our livelihood in pleasure and not in sorrow, and we shall by no means, due to livelihood, not be able to make the Sabbath or holidays weekly, and we shall be able to rest on the holy days and serve you with all of our hearts. So this is being sold in America. Women are saying this on the Lower East Side. It shows the way that women have negotiated and adapted to their situation. Just because their husbands work or just because their children might work, they hold the Friday night Sabbath as sacred. And I think it's fascinating to me that this prayer came about because I think there's a conditionality implied in this. If you, God, can make it so that our children and parent and husbands don't have to work, then the Sabbath will be complete. But in the meantime, it's not, but we're doing what we can. And I think that this is going on the Lower East Side throughout the tenement districts. Thursday night and Friday are the busiest days for shopping in the markets. Fridays are the days that the bathhouses get most use. So even though you have many of these people, especially the children and the fathers working on Saturday, working on the Sabbath, the women who have the domain of their home, and again, whether it's Beekman Place or a tenement apartment, they can bring the Sabbath spirit into the home and work hard in order to negotiate and adapt and do that. We don't have here, but in the collection is a collection of Lower East Side maps that we don't have out. But what's amazing about these maps, when you look at the Lower East Side, and you can look, they're fire insurance, originally created for insurance purposes, but you see the blocks of Manhattan, and you see on each block the different lots, and you see the extent to which a building filled the lot. So when you look at it as an overview, you see how these blocks were just filled with buildings, and behind the tenements were other buildings to take up rear tenements, to take up the lots. There was no fresh air, there was no sunlight, and this was the context in which these immigrants had to remake their American life. So if you ever have a chance, or when you go through the files, take a look at these maps, because this, more than anything, kind of gives you that overall bird's eye view. And for those of you, have any of you been to the Tenement Museum? Okay, so that's where I live. I mean, I don't live there. I work there, but I live most of my days there. And in each apartment, you get a sense of individuals and how they created their lives. And when I just started working there about a year ago, and most of the Sabbath candlesticks were on mantles, kind of off to the side. A reminder, you know, these people were Jewish, but this is on the mantle. And it wasn't really part of the story that we told in the apartments. What I've recently done is reworked one of the apartments so that now the Sabbath candlesticks are on a table, and the story and the supplication that I just read to you, the prayer book is there. And so in that apartment, what had been told was a story of Shiva, of a father of a family dying. What we did is we changed it. It's before he dies, and it's the family, the Rogoshevsky family, from Telšiai, Lithuania. They have 6 children: Ida, Bessie, Morris, Sam, Henry, and Philip. 3 are European-born, 3 are American-born, rather than Greg, Cindy, Jan. 3 of them go off to work right away, because in these East European Jewish families, they rely on the wages of their children. What we do then is say, what are Fanny Rogoshevsky's choices here? Her daughter, Bessie and Ida, are going to go off to work. What is she going to do? And visitors themselves start to piece together what she does, right? And talk about the choices they're making, the negotiations they're making, because this is an active part of adapting to America, which the women took the lead on. So I invite you to see that as well. And I'll just end with a poem. It's not quite the same stature as Emma Lazarus's, but it weaves back to this idea of candlesticks. It's a poem by a man named Getzel Zilikovich, who was a writer for many of the Yiddish newspapers. He also wrote sermons. He published a collection of bar mitzvah speeches for boys. So if you didn't want to write your bar mitzvah speech, you could buy this book. And it was written in Yiddish and English. But this is one, I love this one. It's about... it's called Die Shabbos Lichts in Hester Street, so the Sabbath Candles of Hester Street. And he runs into a woman on Hester Street. Buy candles for Shabbos women. These are my last 4 candles. These words I heard last Thursday when I was walking by Hester Street. The peddler of candles was an old woman, poorly dressed. Under her arm, she also had a pack of Yiddish newspapers, and in one hand, the last 4 candles. These 4 candles, she said to me after I bought something from her, these 4 candles are what remains of 12. Ah, mister, if my candles could only talk. See, not all of the candles I sell have the same luck. Some fall into a house where they keep the Sabbath truly. Others come into a house where they light candles only to please an old mother, but where they desecrate the Sabbath in front of the candles shine or the candles light as soon as the greenhorn turns around a bit. And it keeps going on and on. One candle happens upon a house where young and old keep the Sabbath, and another candle comes to a house where the children run out after the tzimis to eat a plate of oysters. Feh, feh, a crazy world, no. And it goes on and on and on, but and it's humorous, but it really shows the reality that all these immigrants are arriving. There's no one that tells them how to live their religious life, right? You have the sisterhood women coming to tell them how to do hygiene or how to, you know, take your kids to a special kindergarten. But these women on their own are trying to figure out ways to adapt their families to the currents of America and of New York. So all of this is a kind of long-winded way of saying that, you know, I love the story that these candles tell us are fascinating. But the real story begins once people get to America and figure out how to live their lives. And the archives here at the American Jewish Historical Society shows you the way that many individual women charted their paths, but also the way, probably even more significantly, and you'll hear about this this afternoon, that organizations led by women took the kind of path in doing this adaptation. So, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Lilith podcast. Check out the Lilith website for more podcasts, plus the Lilith blog, online anthologies, back issues, and much more. That's www.lilith.org.